This is the Young Farmers Podcast. I'm Lindsay Lesher Shoot. Today, we're sharing a conversation between Michelle Hughes, a member of our team, and Leah Penniman, farmer and food justice activist at Soul Fire Farm. Leah is also the author of a new book, Farming While Black, Soul Fire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land. Leah talks about her history, her spirituality, and her work training the next generation of Black and brown farmers to build a more sustainable and equitable food system.
Hi, I'm Camille Cody, farm manager at Grand Oak Farm in East Tennessee and a leader of the East Tennessee Young Farmers Coalition. I'm a member of the National Young Farmers Coalition because I love growing food and flowers, and there's a real threat to our nation's food security and local economies as many farmers are aging out of business and young people can't afford land or health care. For $35 a year, you can join this amazing coalition of people too. In addition to being part of a bright and just future for agriculture in the United States, you'll also get discounts like 33% off Growing for Market subscriptions, 10% off DripWorks irrigation supplies, and other awesome tools and workwear. To join, go to youngfarmers.org.
I want to say I'm really honored and excited to be interviewing you right now. I think you're doing, obviously, really incredibly powerful and healing work for Black people at Soul Fire. And it's been really important to me personally, and now you have a really highly anticipated new book out. I guess I just want to start, can you just introduce yourself?
Absolutely, and thanks so much for having me. My name is Leah Penniman, and I am a farmer and food justice activist at Soul Fire Farm.
Can you describe Soul Fire Farm today and the work that you're doing there?
Yeah, Soul Fire Farm, I sometimes jokingly say, is like our third child after our biological human children. It's very dear to me. And we are a Black and brown-centered community farm that's dedicated to ending racism and injustice in the food system, which sounds really lofty and abstract, but the work we do day-to-day is quite practical. We have three main areas where we work. The first is to run a working commercial farm that provides vegetables, fruits, eggs, poultry, and we center the needs of refugees, immigrants, and those impacted by mass incarceration and police violence in our farm share and food distribution. And everything we grow, we use Afro-Indigenous practices and heirloom seeds and, you know, are very committed to leaving the earth and the land better than how we found it. So that's the first thing we do. The second relates to training, equipping, and resourcing the next generation of Black and brown farmers. And so we have a number of training programs ranging from a day to a whole season to support this returning generation of folks to reclaim their ancestral right to belong to the land. And then the final thing is organizing to change the structures that hold up and bolster this racist food system. So we work regionally and nationally on land reparations, on policy shifts, and other initiatives to make sure that everybody, regardless of their backgrounds, can have access to lands, can be a farmer with dignity, and also be able to consume culturally appropriate and healthy foods. That's like the quick version of Soul Fire.
It's a lot, and I think it also sort of explains why the book that you've written is so comprehensive. I mean, that's my first impression of it. You know, it's part Black farming history. It's a technical guide. It's a cookbook. It's a teaching manual, and so much more. And I love that you say it's a reverently compiled manual for African heritage people ready to reclaim our rightful place of dignified agency in the food system. It's a book that I wish that I had as a Black girl growing up in New Jersey and wanting, you know, feeling the connection to farming and not really understanding it or knowing until much later how to connect. Could you just talk a little bit about, like, who, you know, your target audience, who you had in mind, and sort of why you chose the form of the book that you did and such a comprehensive guide?
Well, I love that you mentioned, you know, being a Black girl in Jersey and needing this book, because that really is my primary audience, is my younger self, because I started farming as a teen and felt really disillusioned when I went to farming conferences and was surrounded by white, mostly male presenters and authors, and wondered if I had a place of belonging in the movement, you know, if it was
if I was something of a race trader, to be caring about the environment and the land. And what I didn't know and what I've learned through the years at Soulfire and in writing this book is that Black people have a history in regenerative agriculture that is not circumscribed by slavery and sharecropping and tenant farming, that we have a tens of thousands year old history of really innovating and coming up with dignified solutions to solving hunger in our communities without destroying the planet. So everything from raised beds and terraces to polycultures and vermicompost, these things, you know, originated in Africa. And having an understanding of this was very healing for me and something that I wanted to share with the broader community. We have a waiting list well over a year long for our training programs, and it seems like inappropriate to gatekeep a lot of this information. So by putting in a book and sharing it, it allows a decentralized access to the true history of Black farming, as well as the story of Soulfire Farm, and a really practical how-to. And to me, that's so important because we can theorize all we want and we can tweet insults at each other and talk about everything that's messed up in the world. But if we don't know how to actually be and create the change we wish to see, then nothing fundamentally is going to shift. So I wanted this book to be grounded very much in the practical.
Could you talk a little bit about like how you came to that realization that, you know, you were continuing this legacy, this really important legacy, and that it was part of your heritage, and also how you overcame that trauma and how you help other people come through it also?
Yeah, the trauma runs deep. Even the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Holocaust survivors carry markers in their epigenetics. So, you know, trauma isn't just transmitted socially and culturally, it's really transmitted cellularly. And I think that's definitely true for Black folks who are descendants of enslaved Africans. Time and again, people come out to the lands and make references, make jokes about slavery, or say, I don't stoop, I can't do stoop work because, you know, my grandparents ran away from that, and I'm better than that now. I can't get dirty. I can't be around insects. And I think that something that's very tragic about that is while the land was certainly the scene of the crime, right? The land wasn't the crime. And I believe that in escaping the terrorism that took place on the red clays of Georgia and other places in the South to come to the paved streets of the North, we did leave a little bit of our souls behind, a little bit of this aching space that we aren't quite sure how to fill. And in connecting to the land, whether that means, you know, being farmers or gardeners or recreating or eating good food, you know, we restore that contact with that source of wisdom. The earth herself is a source of wisdom. Also, the ancestors under the ground is a source of wisdom. That is so important to me. And I think the way that we address it at Soulfire is really head on is when we do our training programs, we talk about these things. We talk about what happened with slavery and sharecropping and the lynching that happened on the lands and the role of the Black farmers in the civil rights movement. And just this whole beautiful tangled history we've had with soil, and give opportunity to use our ancestral healing methods to address that trauma. So we'll be drumming and dancing and using spiritual bath and telling stories and other ways that we have to process and become free of our trauma. I know for me personally, it was really clear to me from the time I was young that I belonged to the earth and that she also felt belonging with me. And I actually used the earth as a way to escape the real life, real time trauma of racial bullying that was happening at my school. And so it wasn't so much how am I going to get back to the land despite these feelings of alienation. It was like, how am I going to let all my people know that we can all get back to the land? So a lot of it was a process of research and discovery to understand, you know, truer and deeper narratives of wholeness.
So you mentioned spirituality and it, you know, your farming practices and activism are like clearly grounded in a deep and eclectic spirituality. You're initiated as a manye in the Odumashe Korobo tradition in Ghana, but you also bring in aspects of obviously your husband Jonah's Jewish faith and many others as well. And I think, you know, spirituality is something that's generally lacking in the sustainable agriculture movement and the predominantly white-led environmental movement in the U.S. But now there seems to be sort of a growing awareness, you know, in these movements of the role and importance of spirituality. Can you talk a little bit more about how and why it's important for you to weave spirituality into your farming and organizing work and kind of what this looks like on a practical day-to-day level?
Yeah, so my spiritual elders who live in Udumasi Krobo in Ghana, West Africa, among the many things that they taught me, we had one conversation where the Queen Mothers there were just incredulous to hear that farmers in the United States would plant a seed and not pour any libation, nor sing any song, nor dance any dance, nor pray a prayer, and expect this seed to bring forth a crop that would be living and nourishing. And they said, essentially, no wonder y'all are sick, you know, because you're treating the land as a material thing and not a living orisha, not a living lua, a living spirit. So it's always been a part of my personal and private practice to use both Jewish and African traditional practices in terms of honoring and revering land and ancestors. It only came into a more public view when I started to observe that despite the fact that our farmer training programs were all about cat and exchange capacity and aggregate stability, people were experiencing a type of healing and connection that wasn't about the mind alone or the body alone. It was really the psycho-spiritual healing and connection. And seeing that thirst and that need that folks had in the community, I was like, well, let me just try something out. I'll just mention, you know, if anyone wants to come over and do this herbal bath, you know, it's a tradition after you kill chickens or do anything that's at the nexus of life and death, you know, this is a bath that we do. And everybody came, you know, everybody wanted to be involved. And it's been profoundly enriching to be able to bring our whole selves to that and not have to compartmentalize aspects of being human.
And so, you know, once you kind of more publicly brought that into your work, can you talk a little bit more about how you see, you know, how that changed you and the farm and other people working there?
Yeah, I think it's subtle and profound how a spiritual practice transforms our relationship to the earth and each other. You know, take, for example, the fact that we have a housing shortage at Soulfire. So a lot of folks come through. We need housing for staff, apprentices, program participants. And so we were getting ready to clear a part of the forest to put up some platform tents and a cabin. But our commitment, because we believe that the forest is a friend and has a sovereign right to its own life, we don't just go and cut down the trees, right? We all, as an entire farm team, went to the forest. We made offerings. We sang songs. And we used a divination tool to get a yes or no answer from the forest about whether it was willing to accommodate this human habitat. We did get a yes, but sometimes we don't. You know, it took us 10 years before we dug out a silted in pond that we really wanted for irrigation, you know, because the pond was like, nah. And eventually we realized what the missing thing was. The missing thing was our reverence for a particular orisha named Dana Baruku. And so in integrating that, the pond was willing to be dug out and have the ecosystem transformed. But in that slowing down process, it obviously has an immediate effect of shifting the way that we have been taught to view the earth and our sense of urgency and our sense of entitlement, you know. But in the long term, if you sort of multiply that out and imagine what it would be like if we all came with gratitude and seeking permission with our non-human siblings, you know, we wouldn't be in a lot of the crises that we're in now with climate change and dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico and topsoil loss, because it wouldn't just be about short-term extraction and profit. It would be about a long-term relationship of mutual respect.
You know, I'm also wondering how you see your work sort of building on the work of other Black farmers and activists. And I'm wondering how you see your work building on that legacy and how you see it connected to it and moving it forward.
Sure. Yeah, we definitely didn't come up with the idea of regenerative agriculture or community-based farming. You know, our ancestors, both here on this continent and abroad, have been doing that for a long, long time. So we are standing on their shoulders. I think our food distribution program and CSA is very much
inspired by the Black Panthers Free Breakfast Program, which fed 20,000 Oakland children every morning and became a model for the government free breakfast program. I think about our education programs and Community Farm as being inspired by the work of Shirley and Charles Sherrod, who started the first community land trust in 1969 in Albany, Georgia, which brought together hundreds of Black families, and they ran a farm together. They had education. And also Fannie Lou Hamer's Freedom Farm, which was a collective of farmers and families, and they provided scholarships and burial fees and a pig bank, livestock share, you know, for their community. And then when I think about, you know, the agricultural practices themselves, certainly we can take it way back to the Mother Continent, but even more recently, ancestors like Booker T. Watley, who came up with Pick Your Own and the idea of the CSA, George Washington Carver, who is one of the earliest proponents of regenerative agriculture in the United States. There's really hundreds of ancestors who inspire us, and we always want to throw it back to that because sometimes we get in an ahistorical myth, I think, as a generation where we think that permaculture just sprang up out of nowhere, you know, and is not rooted in indigenous and African practices. But of course it is.
So I have a question. It's not fully formed. So one of the big challenges for Black farmers now is air property. And so my understanding is that it's with land being passed down without wills from, you know, one generation to the next. Now we have this circumstance where, you know, there's so many owners that it makes it really hard for, you know, the people who are, you know, part of those families who are actually on the land to get loans from the federal government or access programs or, you know, and in a lot of cases, they're losing ownership of the land because of, you know, other non-farming family members who want to sell it and are in a lot of cases even being sort of tricked or swindled out of ownership of the land, sort of like dishonest practices. There are a lot of like Black youth in cities in the North who don't even know that they have, you know, that they're heirs to land in the South. And yeah, I'm just wondering if you've thought about like that connection or experienced anything with, you know, with anyone maybe who was going through that or how you see your sort of education work being able to help there.
That is such a powerful question. Mama Savvy Horn of Land Loss Prevention Project helped me understand air property in this whole new way when she said that essentially air property is Black people's efforts to create a commons. So rather than seeing the property as belonging to an individual and being deeded over to an individual or a corporation, that in Black families, just like we did, you know, back in Africa forever and ever, the land goes to your unnameable and innumerable descendants. And to create a will undermines that ability to have the land be shared by those to come. And there's a mismatch there between state law mostly and practice in the Black community, because when a property is considered under heir property ownership, it is ineligible for all types of credit and assistance. And also one disconnected family member can at times force sale of the entire property, have it go up on auction. And so it's a dangerous legal status. And there's certainly plenty of lawyers and plenty of developers who figured out exactly how to exploit those loopholes. And the question about up north folks having access to land is interesting. I hadn't really thought about youth being heirs and not realizing it. I think what I've been exposed to is a lot of returning generation Black and brown farmers who would love to have lands, but they didn't inherit any and they can't afford to buy any. And so right now what we're working with SAFON to create, SAFON is the Southeast African American Farmers Organic Network, is a North-South land link so that farmers, landowners in the South who are Black, who need someone to pass the farm on to can connect through this land link that's specifically around Black farmland to find a young person who's trained up and ready to go, but maybe doesn't have that land access and do a lease to own or do a land trust or, you know, do whatever kind of arrangement is going to make sense for that situation.
Just following that, I took a really short trip to Georgia and Alabama a couple of years ago, and I was really struck by how much land there was. And I visited a lot of Black farmers there. It's almost like they have the opposite problem that we have here in the North, where we have such like incredible access to markets. There's so many people and there's a lot of development pressure on the land. And in Alabama and Georgia, it seemed like a lot of people had left and there's a lot of like open land and land was more affordable. But it also seemed like, yeah, there was this question of, you know, access to markets, but then also just like rebuilding that like social network. So I'm just wondering if you've thought through like farmers from the North going down South, building those connections with the Black farmers who are there.
That is so true. And, you know, I don't think it's confined to the South in terms of the challenges of cultural isolation and rebuilding social infrastructure. Certainly up north, we have high development pressure. We have more access to markets. So the economic considerations are different. But one of the reasons we created the Northeast Farmers of Color Mutual Aid Network is because time and again, Black and brown farmers who are living rurally and actually farming are like, I'm the only one out here. It's a little scary sometimes. I feel isolated. I need my people. And so, you know, folks will drive like 4 or 6 hours to get to one of these potlucks, one of these gatherings, to be with folks like them. And I think that there's some things that may be adaptable to the South from that model of both thinking about what are those networks, but also what are the ways that we can think beyond the family farm as being rooted in the nuclear family and have more, you know, freedom farm style or new community style cooperative farms. But I would really hesitate, for example, to match a Brooklynite, you know, urban farmer with someone in rural Alabama and just say, yeah, just go have fun on that tractor. Like, that's not going to work. We don't have those structures in place yet. I think we need them. I want to applaud, you know, Dennis Derrick and Corbin Hill Food Project for doing some thinking about how to create markets up north for Black farmers down south, and figuring out the shipping and the trucking. And I think that will be really powerful. I've actually talked to some farmers at the Black Farmers Conference just a couple weeks ago in Durham who were saying that when they figured out how to tap into like New York City, Chicago markets, things really shifted for them.
Yeah. And I was also, when you were talking, thinking about how, you know, your experience starting Soulfire in a very rural white community. So I'm wondering if you could just talk about some of like the challenges that you've had with Soulfire, both like getting it started in the community where it is and also just constantly having sort of this beautiful community, but also how you sort of, you know, as an activist and a farmer, like, you know, have like self-care and sorry, that's like two questions.
Well, that's a lot. Let me see if I got all those questions.
It's like two different questions, probably.
I mean, as I'm sure most people who listen to this podcast know, like farming is real and everything that has to do with farming and food system work. It is not prancing through a field of daisies in a white skirt and like harvesting them into a basket. You know, it's like it's cold, it's tiring, the hours are long, we get discouraged, we fight with each other. So all of that is really important to know. And I think that, you know, having self-care routines in place, if you can do it, like power to you, it makes a lot of sense. I definitely make sure I at least get my run in every day. And that's a chance to be by myself and get some exercise that's not, you know, producing product for other people. And living out here, it's a joy and a challenge. It was interesting when we were running up to the last election, you know, our whole community is just filled with Trump signs. And a friend of mine had to remind me, like, if you look straight ahead, like, that's what you see, right? But if you look up, you see the sky and the mountains and the treetops, which is so much bigger and so much more powerful and so much more enduring. I feel like that's a grounding that I have to keep bringing myself back to. Like, we're here for the long game. Like, we're part of a 10,000-year-old story. We're not part of a 4-year election cycle story, you know? And on a practical level, you know, we've certainly made sure to make as many positive relationships with our neighbors as we can, even if that means omitting sensitive topics. You know, we're human beings and there's goodness in most people. And so we try to find points of connection around that goodness. And, you know, other times you just got to keep your head down and mind your business.
There's a chapter where you talk about kind of like the finances of starting your farm. And you were a public school teacher before, I guess, I actually don't even know if you're still doing that part-time. So I'm just wondering if you can maybe talk about that and talk about when you were starting the farm and sort of what that process was like.
Yes, I am still teaching high school part-time. Wow. So, and I know I'm not alone. Last time I looked, it was well over 90% of small farms had some kind of side hustle outside job. So that is the case. But yeah, I was working in public school before that and did save between a third and half of our salary from that to build up the project. And it was all our own labor and labor of friends. It was totally out of pocket. You know, we've only had a nonprofit for about 2 years and been able to pay anyone. And we started in 2006. You know, I mean, grit is an important ingredient. So I think of this one particular time when, you know, we didn't have money to hire someone to do excavation for us. So we thought we could use our little tractor and shovels to dig the foundation of our home and education center. And we're mad stubborn. And despite the hard pan clay and boulders in the soil of the mountains, we were just like, we're going to do this. And it took us months and we dug it. And then right before pouring the foundation, you know, realized that we had actually made a mistake. And we wanted the home to be a passive solar, which means it has to face solar self. And it was about 13 degrees off because magnetic self, which is what you see on a compass, is not the same as solar self. So we're in this hole, like covered in mud with bloody calluses and crying. And, you know, Jonah's like, do you want to quit? I'm like, no. I was like, do you want to quit? He's like, no. You know, so we just redug it, reoriented the whole thing 13 degrees. And here I am right now in my, you know, warm and cozy straw bale passive solar home. But, you know, so many points along the way like that where it would just be easy to walk away and do something basic. And we never made that choice.
What gets you through that? You know, like what is it that, you know, got you to the other side and didn't make you want to quit?
I mean, the honest answer to that is we're just both mad stubborn and we're not quitters. So we have a sometimes dangerous complementary personality where we'll just push each other because neither of us is going to back down or say it's impossible. We're like, if it needs to be done, it will be done. But also, getting the feedback and seeing the impact of the work is makes a big difference. You know, if nobody cared if we were doing this, I'm not going to be killing myself out here for it. But because so many folks come through and are like, this training program, like not only was one of the most powerful in terms of leveling up my skills as a farmer, but I feel like for the first time I've tasted, smelled, touched freedom. And I'm not going to settle anymore for anything less than being my full magical self. Getting feedback like that time and again from folks is also keeps us going because we feel accountable to what the community is expecting of us.
So one particularly important question for the National Young Farmers Coalition is allyship and how to be an ally in racial justice work. You know, the organization has right now predominantly white leadership. And then the last few years, we've kind of started on a path to work to dismantle racism in agriculture. And a question that comes up fairly often is, you know, what does it mean to be an ally? How do you hold yourself accountable to people of color in this work? And I know that sort of more recently you've started, you know, in addition to the sort of like healing and liberation work with people of color, you've started more dismantling racism work with white people. And I know from personal experience that this work is really exhausting and re-traumatizing. And you talk in the book about, you know, one day like having to go dig a hole after doing a workshop because it was so hard. Two-part question. You know, what does it mean to be an ally? And then also, how do you recover from doing dismantling racism work with white people?
It's a great question. Yeah, it definitely can be taxing to hold that space. But I do think as a Black woman with light skin, as someone with education privilege, you know, to the extent that I'm able, I see it as my responsibility and duty to do that type of work. But it needs to be rationed out for sure. And as far as, you know, what folks can do to be allies and accomplices, you know, certainly no one should listen to the voice of one person. Like, I can't speak for all people of color, all Black people, or all anything. I can say that some of the work we've done to collaborate with allies is around creating a policy platform and action steps to support Black and brown farmers. And it's on our website, soulfirefarm.org, under support and take action. And what that is a whole compilation that comes from us deeply listening to our constituency, to folks who are coming through our program, saying this is what needs to shift if we're going to be able to have lives of dignity and financial sustainability on land. Similarly, we started a reparations map, which came out of one of our alumni, Viviana Moreno, who said, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if we could just put all of our asks in one place? And these are Black and brown farmers who maybe need land, they need a tractor, technical assistance, money for their projects. And so we've developed a map where farmers put on the map what their needs are, and then people who are motivated towards reparations can go ahead and contribute directly to those farmers. And so those are, I think, what those two things have in common, and I guess the thread that I'll pull out there is that the role of white folks, allies and accomplices, is to follow the lead of people of color in terms of what we're asking for and what we're saying needs to be done and how we say it needs to be done. I've heard it termed white followers, which I haven't figured out how I feel about that term, but I think it does. It's jarring enough and interesting enough that I think it provokes the right conversation about what it means to, you know, not try to be a white savior and go and make everything according to your own image.
I wanted to say that in your chapter on finding land, you quote Ralph Page at the beginning from the Federation of Southern Cooperatives saying, "Land is the only real wealth in this country, and if we don't own any, then we're out of the picture." And the National Young Farmers Coalition, last year we did a survey of young farmers across the country, and this is the number one, land access is the number one challenge that we found. And I know that right now you're working with the Northeast Farmers of Color Network to launch a land trust. Can you just talk a little bit about why it's so important for Black people to own land and what you're hoping to achieve with the new land trust?
Absolutely. The original sin of this nation, I believe, was the genocide and dispossession of millions of Native people from their land. And that legacy of land theft has continued. So Black folks post-Reconstruction managed to purchase 14% of the nation's farmland at the time, some 16 million acres. And almost all of that has been taken back by the white community to the point where right now, nearly all the land is in European control, European heritage control in the United States, with Black farmers having just over 1%. And while I don't necessarily adhere to the European idea of enclosure and private property, it is important to own land collectively, whether that's through land trusts or LLCs or other mechanisms, because ownership is the currency of self-determination in the United States. There is no way to create intergenerational wealth or to have long-term security without ownership. So that is very important. And the work that we are doing with the Northeast Farmers of Color to create a land trust is a collaboration between Indigenous communities in the Northeast and Black and brown farmers to
catalyze reparations, to catalyze people to give land back that can be held in a common trust and then in turn leased out with long-term secure leases to farmers and land stewards. We're moving at the pace of trust, so it'll take a little while, but we should see a launch in 2019.
Is there anything else that you want to tell us that I didn't ask you about?
I think the one thing I want to say is I just want to shout out the whole Soulfire team. I think sometimes we get in this celebrity activism trap where we think it's just one or two people who make the project work. But of course, we're a whole team. So Ceci, Olive, Letitia, Demaris, and Larissa are our farm team. Jess, Amani, and I do programs. And Jonah, Nishima, and Emmett work on infrastructure. And we really could not do any of this without all of us. And so if anyone ever tells you that they're figured out their whole life and farm and organization by themselves, they're not telling the truth. It's a we thing. It always has been, and it will be going forward.
Thank you, Lee and Michelle. If you want to know more, please check out the Soulfire website. It has a ton of resources. We'll link to it in today's show notes and on our Instagram at Young Farmers Podcast. For those of you who voted this week, nicely done, people. It was awesome to hear about the turnout across the nation. If you have a second, please pick up the device you're probably using to listen to this podcast on and rate us on iTunes. Seriously, it cannot be more important. Also, I promise I will personally thank anyone who rates us right on this podcast. As always, this podcast was recorded at Radio Kingston and edited by Hannah Beale. Talk to you next week.